Henri Fayol is a French industrialist. His dates are 1841 to 1925. He was born into a middle-class family near Lyon, France. He trained as a mining engineer. He joined a coal and iron combine as an apprentice, and he rose to the top position of management director in 1888. He accomplished the difficult task of moving the company out of several financial difficulties and into a very strong position by the time of his retirement at age 77. The company still survives today and is a large mining company in central France. On the basis of his experience as a top-level manager, Fayol was convinced that it should be possible to develop theories about management that could then be taught to individuals and administrative responsibilities as well. His efforts toward developing such theories were published and titled General and Industrial Management. Fayol attempted to isolate the main types of activities involved in industry or business. Within the category of managerial activities, he delineated five major functions. These are planning, organizing, commanding, coordinating, and controlling. Thinking of management as encompassing these functions is known as the functional approach to management. You probably notice the similarity between Fayol's functions and the four functions of management which we discussed earlier in our cassette lectures, that is planning, organizing, leading, and controlling. These are actually used many times as a framework for managerial study and managerial discussions. Many contemporary books on management use a form of the functional approach that has its roots in Fayol's work. Fayol also outlined a number of principles that he found useful in running his large coal and iron concern. Although contemporary research has found exceptions to his principles under certain conditions, the principles are still generally in wide use today. Let me just mention some of these principles that were advocated by Henri Fayol. One principle of management is what he called the division of work. Work specialization can result, he said, in efficiencies and is certainly applicable to both managerial and technical functions. Yet there are limitations to how much that work should be divided. And then a second principle is the principle of authority. Authority, according to Fayol, is the right to give orders and the power to exact obedience. It derives from the formal authority of the office and from personal authority based on factors like intelligence and experience. He also said that with authority comes responsibility. And then a third general principle, which Fayol emphasized as a principle of management, is the principle of discipline. Discipline, he said, is absolutely necessary for the smooth running of an organization. But the state of discipline depends essentially on the worthiness of its leaders. Even in modern managerial study, the emphasis is certainly coming back to the idea of ethics and the idea of honesty and integrity. And then a fourth general principle of management, which was advocated by Fayol, is the unity of command. An employee should receive orders from one superior only. And then number five, he identified what he called the unity of direction. Activities aimed at the same objective should be organized so that there is one plan and one person in charge. And then a sixth principle of management that Fayol emphasized was the subordination of individual interest to general interest. The interest of one employee or group should not prevail over the interest and goals of the organization. And then he emphasized remuneration. Compensation, he said, should be fair to both the employee and the employer. He emphasized centralization. The proper amount of centralization or decentralization depends, he said, on the situation. The object is the optimum use of capabilities of the individuals involved. He also talked about order Material should be kept in well-chosen places that facilitate activities. Similarity, due to good organization and selection, the right person should be in the right place. He talked about equity. Employees should be treated with kindness and justice. He mentioned the stability of personnel tenure. Because time is required to become effective in new jobs, high turnover should be prevented. He talked about initiative. Managers should encourage and develop subordinate initiative to the fullest. And he emphasized the unity, or the sense of spirit and oneness. Since union is strength, harmony and teamwork are essential. These are just some of the principles that Thiel discussed and developed in his own understanding of management theory. And again, as you think of those principles, even as they've been listed here just in a very summary, cursive fashion, you can see illustrations of these in modern organizations. Again, in the area of administrative management, we have the name of Chester Bernard. Another major contributor to administrative management was Chester Bernard. His dates are 1886 to 1961. Chester was born in Massachusetts. He attended Harvard, but he did not complete his degree work. After joining AT&T as a statistician, he rose rapidly and eventually was named the president of New Jersey Bell Telephone in 1927. Bernard recorded his observations about effective administration in a single classic book, The Functions of the Executive. This book was published in 1938. One of Bernard's best-known contributions in his acceptance theory of authority. This theory argues that authority does not depend as much on persons of authority who give orders as on the willingness to comply of those who receive the orders. Thus, in Bernard's view, it's really the employees who decide whether or not an order or a directive is going to be accepted. From a practical point of view, Bernard felt that managers are generally able to exert authority on a day-to-day basis because each individual possesses what he called zone of indifference, within which the individual is willing to accept orders and directions without much question. On the basis of his view that authority flows from the bottom to the top, Bernard argued that employees are more willing to accept directions from a manager if they, number one, understand the communication, number two, see the communication as consistent with the purposes of the organization, number three, feel that the actions indicated are in line with their needs and those of other employees, and number four, view themselves as mentally and physically able to comply. Bernard helped integrate concern with authority, which is growing out of the administrative and bureaucratic approaches, with emphasis on work needs, which was simultaneously developing within the behavioral viewpoint, which we'll see shortly. He also knew of the early behaviorists and the Hawthorne studies, which were a primary force in the development of the behavioral viewpoint. And it is this particular viewpoint that we want to discuss at this point. Perhaps just a moment of review, just to bring ourselves once again together. We began this discussion on the birth of management ideas or the evolution of management with some pre-classical contributors. We talked about Robert Owen, Charles Babbage, Henry Towne. We then came to what was known as the classical viewpoint. Within the classical viewpoint, there is scientific management. Within the classical viewpoint, there is also bureaucratic management. Within the classical viewpoint, there is administrative management. Now we turn to the behavioral viewpoint. The classical theorist generally viewed individuals as mechanisms of production. As a result, they were primarily interested in finding ways for organizations to use these productive mechanisms more effectively. The idea that an employee's behavior might be influenced by internal reactions to various aspects of job situations was generally not seen as particularly relevant to the quest for greater efficiency. In contrast, the behavioral viewpoint is a perspective that emphasizes the importance of attempting to understand the various factors that affect human behavior in organizations. In exploring this viewpoint, we examine several aspects of its development. We need to look at the contributions of early behavioralists. Then, especially, we need to notice the Hawthorne studies. We need to examine the human relations movement. And then we need to come to the more contemporary behavioral scientific approach. Let's begin. Think of the early behaviorist. With the growing interest in the subject of management, individuals from other backgrounds began to offer alternatives to the emphasis on engineering that characterized the scientific management approach. Two early behaviorists were psychologist Hugo Munsterberg and political scientist Mary Parker Follett. Both of these contributed pioneering ideas that helped make the behavioral perspective a major viewpoint. First, let's look at Hugo Munsterberg. He was born and educated in Germany. His dates are 1863 to 1916. He earned both a Ph.D. in psychology and a medical degree. In 1892, he set up a psychological laboratory at Harvard and began seeking practical applications for psychology. Before long, his attention turned to industrial applications, leading him to publish an important book, Psychology and Industrial Efficiency, which appeared in 1913. The book argued that psychologists could help industry in three major ways. The first was closely allied to scientific management. Psychologists could study jobs and find ways of identifying the individuals who are best suited to particular jobs. In contrast, the other two ways inherently recognized that factors beside those considered by the classical theorists might influence behavior at work. According to Munsterberg, the second way that psychologists could help industry was by identifying the psychological conditions under which individuals are likely to do their best work. The third was by developing strategies that would influence employees to behave in ways that are compatible with managerial interest. The ideas and examples he provided ignited the imagination of others, and it led to the establishment of the field of industrial psychology, the study of human behavior in a work setting. Thus, Munsterberg is often called and considered the father of industrial psychology. Another early well-known behaviorist was Mary Parker Follett. Her dates 1868 to 1933. Mary Parker Follett was born in Boston, educated in political science at what is now Radcliffe College. Follett was a social worker who became interested in employment and workplace issues. Follett attributed much greater significance to the functioning of groups and organizations than did proponents of the classical view of management. She argued that members of organizations are continually influenced by the groups within which they operate. In fact, she held that groups have the capacity to exercise control over themselves and their own activities, a concept that is now compatible with the recent interest of self-management teams in American business. Another of Follett's forward-looking ideas was her belief that organizations should operate on the principle of power with rather than power over. Power to her was the general ability to influence and to bring about change. She argued that power should be a jointly developed cooperative concept involving employees and managers working together rather than a coercive concept based upon hierarchical pressure. Although her views probably influenced Bernard's acceptance theory of authority, Follett advocated sharing power, whereas Bernard emphasized encouraging the appropriate response from below. Follett suggested that one way to foster the power with concept was by resolving conflict through integration. By integration, she meant the process of finding a solution that would satisfy both parties. She cited an example involving a dairy cooperative that almost disbanded because of a controversy over the pecking order in the unloading of milk cans. The creamery was located on the downgrade of a hill, and members who came downhill and those who came uphill both thought they should be given greater precedence in the unloading process. The situation was at an impasse until an outsider pointed out that the position of the loading dock could be changed so that both groups could unload their cans at the same time. Follett noted, "Integration involves invention, and the clever thing is to recognize this, and not to let one's thinking stay within the boundaries of two alternatives that are mutually exclusive." Her ideas on integration heralded modern methods of conflict resolution. Follett placed great importance on achieving what she called integrative unity, whereby the organization would operate as a functional whole with the various interrelated parts working together effectively to achieve organizational goals. Yet she saw the process of working together as a dynamic process because of the environmental factors involved that would necessitate change. One recent review of her work has argued that its overall significance rivals the long-standing influence of such giants as Taylor and Fayol. The Hawthorne studies certainly need to be mentioned at this point. While Follett was doing her speaking and writing, a number of researchers were involved in the Hawthorne studies. The Hawthorne studies are a group of studies conducted at the Hawthorne plant of the Western Electric Company during the late 1920s and the early 1930s, whose results ultimately led to the human relations view of management, a behavioral approach that emphasized concern for the worker. To understand their significance, we need to trace the studies from their beginning. When they started, the Hawthorne studies reflected the scientific management tradition of seeking greater efficiency by improving the tools and methods of work, in this case, the lighting. The General Electric Company wanted to sell more light bulbs, so along with other electric companies, it supported studies on the relationship between lighting and productivity that would be conducted by the National Research Council. The tests were to be held at the Hawthorne Works, Chicago, of the Western Electric Company, an equipment-producing subsidiary of AT&T. Ultimately, three sets of studies were done. The first set of studies, called the Illumination Studies, took place between 1924 and 1927 under the direction of several engineers. In one of these studies, light was decreased over successive periods for an experimental group, the group for whom the lighting was altered, while light was held at a constant level for the control group. This is a comparison group working in a separate area. In both groups, performance rose steadily, even though the lighting for the experimental group became so dim that the workers complained they could hardly see. At that point, performance in the experimental group finally began to decline. The researchers concluded that factors other than lighting were at work, since performance actually rose in both groups, and the project was discontinued. In retrospect, one possibility based on the records of the study is that the experimental and control groups were in contact and may have begun comparing notes with one another. Then there was a second set of studies. Intrigued with the positive changes in productivity, some of the engineers and company officials decided to attempt to determine the cause through further studies. Accordingly, a second set of experiments took place between 1927 and 1933. The most famous study involved five women who assembled electrical relays in the relay assembly test room, where they were away from other workers and the researchers could alter work conditions and evaluate the results. Before the study began, the researchers were apparently concerned about possible negative reaction from the workers who would be included in the experiment. To lessen potential resistance, the researchers changed the usual supervisory arrangement so that there would be no official supervisor. Instead, the workers would operate under the general direction of the experimenter. The workers were also given special privileges, such as being able to leave their workstations without permission, and they received considerable attention from the experimenters as well as company officials. The study was aimed at exploring the best combination of work and rest periods, but a number of other factors were also varied, sometimes simultaneously, such as pay, the length of the workday, the provisions for free lunch, and so forth. Generally, productivity increased over the period of the study, regardless of how the factors under consideration were manipulated. A Harvard University group involved in assessing the results ultimately concluded that the change in the supervisory arrangement was the major reason for the increase in productivity in the relay assembly room study and in two related studies involving different groups. The group felt that the physical changes, such as rest periods, free lunches, shortened hours, as well as group incentive pay, were factors of less importance. Since the supervisory arrangement had been set up by the researchers before the study began, this change was not actually part of the study manipulation and was not intended to affect the results. One outcome of the studies was the identification of a famous concept that ultimately came to be known as the Hawthorne effect. The Hawthorne effect is the possibility that individuals singled out for a study may improve their performance simply because of the added attention they receive from the researchers rather than because of any specific factors being tested in the study. More contemporary investigations now suggest that the Hawthorne effect concept is too simplistic to explain what happened during the Hawthorne studies, and that the concept itself perhaps even is defective. It now appears likely that the results obtained at the Hawthorne plant stem from the fact that the workers interpreted what was going on around them differently than did the researchers. The workers most likely viewed the altered supervision as an important positive change in their work environment, even though that was not what the researchers intended. Then there was a third set of studies. The third set of Hawthorne studies built on the emerging findings of the second set. It included the famous Bank Writing Observation Room study, 1931 to 1932, which involved a group of male workers. Studying the group provided knowledge about informal social relations within groups and about the use of group norms to restrict output when doing so seemed advantageous to the group. Also included in the third study was a massive interviewing program, 1928 to 1931. Initially aimed at improving supervision, the program evolved and not only enabled researchers to learn what workers had on their minds, but also provided workers with a way to let off steam. As a result of the Hawthorne studies, the focus of the field of management was drastically altered. In strong contrast to the impersonality that characterized the classical period, the Hawthorne studies pointed to the impact that social aspects of the job had on productivity, particularly the effects of personal attention from supervisors and relationships that developed among group members. As one writer has pointed out, no other theory or set of experiments has stimulated more research and controversy, nor contributed more to a change in management thinking than the Hawthorne studies and the human relations movement that they spawned. Drawing out and coming from the Hawthorne studies came this particular concept in management known as the human relations movement. However flawed the studies, the Hawthorne research set the stage for intense interest in the social dimensions of human behavior in organizations. The key to productivity at that point appeared to lie in showing greater concern for workers so that they felt more satisfied with their jobs and would be willing to produce more. Emphasis was placed on building more collaborative and cooperative relationships between supervisors and workers. Consequently, managers now needed social skills in addition to technical skills. They also required a better understanding of how to make workers feel more satisfied with their jobs. While the Hawthorne studies provide some clues, managers needed more definite guidance. Two major theorists stepped forward to provide this guidance. One was Abraham Maslow. The other was Douglas McGregor. They came with ideas that managers found helpful. This brings us to the end of number 4.